The following talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi during a Fusatsu ceremony at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. Fusatsu is, we translate as renewal of vows. And vows are understood to be very important in Buddhism because when we make a vow, we're establishing a very strong intention, which means we are, in a sense, aligning or reorganizing our inner world to be in alignment with the nature of that which we are making a vow to. And that creates karma. And so when we make a vow, and we do that formally, and we do in training, we do it publicly, that's a way of really emphasizing or making very clear, not within our own minds, only within our own minds, but within the mind of the Sangha, that we are establishing that vow as a path for our lives. And of course, the purpose of that is to hold us so that we hold ourselves to that vow. We remember, in a sense, what is important. And when we wander, we return. When we don't do that, then the consequences of that, the karmic consequences, are greater because we have made that vow. So that's why we, in our training, students train for a while as formal students, where they take formal vows. And so this evening, in renewing the vows, we make an offering to the Buddha. We do prostrations. We do the God of Atonement. We invoke the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, their qualities, their virtues, their example. And then we take those vows, the Bodhisattva vows, the great vows. What I wanted to talk tonight about a little bit in our theme of right relationship is we translate Sangha as a virtue of harmony. And a Sangha is not just a gathering of people. It's not just a gathering of people in a zendo or in a training center or doing meditation. It's a gathering together of intention, of purpose, of commitment, of accountability, of compassion. And we gather together to practice and discover how do we actually do that? How do we live together in harmony? Because as we see all too well and often, that's not so easy for us as human beings. And so if we're sincere in our practice and our attention, our aspiration, our vow to alleviate suffering and to be of benefit in the world, then we need to be applying that wholeheartedly here with each other. In other words, in our own backyard. To study the self, to forget the self, to realize the self, to be enlightened by the 10,000 things, Dogen says, is to free one's body and mind and those of others. To free our own body and mind and those of others. And so the teachings, our various practices, our training is to help us see how many opportunities we have, how ceaselessly we can be practicing this, and to see very clearly and become very acquainted with those things that obstruct us. In the Four Methods of the Bodhisattva, Dogen says, speaks about these as giving, kind speech, and beneficial action. And these are practices that anyone can do, right? They're fairly accessible, they're fairly easy to understand, to be giving, to give. And the teachings make it very clear that what's most important is not the quantity or the cost or whatever, however we might judge it, but the intention, the heart of the giving. And that kind words is to speak in a way that is encouraging, that is beneficial, that is supportive, that is conducive to helping ourselves as the speaker and others who hear our words in this path. And beneficial actions are those actions that function in similar ways. The fourth of those methods, identity action, is much more profound. Well, I mean, it's not more profound, but it's more transcendent. Dogen describes it as non-difference, the mind that realizes non-difference between ourselves and all things, having the same nature. The precepts bring our attention to those things that we do in our lives and that are universal in human experience that cause some of the most obstructive, binding, painful karma for ourselves and others, that are not freeing one's body and mind and the mind of those of others, but it actually is constricting, diminishing. And so the precepts point to those ways of thinking and speaking and acting that are the most binding, so that we can really know what they are and really pay attention to them and practice them and transform them. I wanted to focus on the mind that judges, the judging mind, to elevate the self and blame others, to speak of others' errors and faults. This mind, this judging mind, is the mind that divides and compares, ranks, elevates, lowers, likes and dislikes, projects. In a sense, it is the non-identity action mind. It is the mind of difference that differentiates, and not just differentiates, doesn't just experience things as in their differences, but projects into those differences something absolute. It's the mind that can be ceaselessly experiencing others from the sense of, who am I compared to you? Who are you compared to me? And of course, we are aware of each other. We are aware of others' errors and faults. We are aware of highs and lows that are established by societies, by culture, by ourselves. So it's not about being blind. It's not about not seeing those things. We have to see them about ourselves. Otherwise, we can't correct what needs to be corrected. We can't come back to the path when we've wandered away. It'll be hard to help each other if we're not able to see more clearly. It's how we learn about each other and ourselves. But it's that mind that is so overly confident about its judgments, that is impulsive in its judgments, that is a little out of control in its judgments. When we see others' errors and faults, even those we love, how frequently that can raise aversion, irritation, annoyance, impatience, anger, hatred, jealousy, envy, pride. That's the discriminating consciousness. It doesn't just see a difference. It doesn't just see an action that may not be very skillful, that may be hurtful. It sees, and it very often brings forth a form of ill will. And that's in us. That's in the mind and body of the one who is judging. The Dalai Lama said that when we examine anger or aversion that is directed towards another, we discover that we've attributed some quality to that person that we find, he says, unattractive, that we find unpleasant, distasteful, offensive. And that attribute, for the one who is angry, seems absolute. It just seems like it is. It's definitive. And so in that absolute sense of an attribute, we fix not just that attribute, but the person. We sort of solidify them. And sort of, in a way, we can reduce them to that one moment, that one attribute. And that's is the Dalai Lama says, is what gives our anger so much strength. It's what gives that judgment so much righteousness and conviction that it's true, because it creates a kind of absolute. And so in the Thanissutta, the Buddha said, it's through living together that we can discover another person's virtue. It's by dealing with them that we can see their purity, how they are sort of combusting themselves, how helpful or hurtful they are being. It's through adversity that we see, discover another person's endurance. How do they meet adversity? It's through discussion that we come to know their mind, how they see things, how they're discerning, how they're understanding. And it's through living together that a person's virtue may be known. And virtue often refers to living the precepts. But what's important about each of those, he said, with each of them, he says, only after a long time. Why? Living together, we can know a person's virtue, their purity, their endurance, and so on, only after a long time. So that we're not basing, coming to a conclusion in a moment. We say one moment, one action, and we know that person based on that action, based on that attribute. He's saying, no, we have to know them for a long time. We have to see them moving through time, different situations, day after day. We can just observe a person on a bad day, in a bad moment. Something's going on that we don't even know about. And then we decide that's all there is. So in that way, we come to know each other. We learn, we discover. And at the same time, other people are doing that to us, right? It's going both ways. And so the precepts, see the perfection, do not speak of others' errors and faults. Realize self and others one. Don't elevate the self and blame others. You know, it's kind of interesting when you think of, sort of hold these two precepts alongside killing, stealing, you know, the more sort of clearly egregious precepts. And you could think, well, you know, to just speak of another's errors and faults is, you know, it's just a little thing. Or to elevate the self and blame others, it's like, yeah, I did that, but it's just a little thing. But we don't just do it once. We do it over and over and over. That's what gives it so much karmic weight. When we do that once, it may not be very significant. It may not be that powerful. May not. But when we do it repeatedly, over and over, we're sort of digging a very deep groove within our mind, our consciousness, our way of seeing and thinking. And so to think about, just to reflect on how many times a day our mind is evaluating, comparing, judging, bringing forth an opinion. When we really begin to look at it, it can be a little scary, right? Because for most people, it's happening pretty much nonstop. In a lot of little moments that we may not notice so much, and not just about people, but all kinds of things. And importantly, how often are those moments of judging, comparing, having opinions tinged with a kind of harshness or aggressiveness or disapproval or dislike? How does that then lead to our relationship with that person? How does it influence? Because it does. It can't not. And how does it affect us? How is it affecting us, the one who is judging? It can't not affect us. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha said, one is you, to put it in the, bring it right home, he said, you are truly your own protector. You are truly your own refuge. Therefore, you should practice your mind. I am truly my own protector. I am truly my own refuge. Therefore, I must practice my mind. No one else can do that for me. No one else can do that for you. And so one way I have approached that over the years, particularly in moments, well, lots of moments, was because that mind, that judging mind, can be extremely righteous, self-righteous. Again, that's what gives it the power. But as the Dalai Lama said, it gains its power from the sense that what we're seeing is not just an ephemeral, impermanent, empty of any intrinsic nature quality, but we're seeing something that we perceive as intrinsic, absolute. And that's why it becomes identified with the person. That's the only way that makes sense, is that the quality that we perceive as intrinsic is identified with the person who we already believe is intrinsic because we believe that of ourselves. And so years ago, I began thinking in such moments of my own, in this moment when I feel so self-righteous, is it more important that I be right or that I be free? Because I began to realize in those moments, I am not free. I'm unhappy, I'm miserable, I'm angry, I'm bringing that out. So what's actually more important? Remember the phrase by Atisha that we studied, the Lojong phrase is, don't ponder others. And Judy Liefen, that says, this points to how easy, entertaining, and totally distracting it can be to muse about what is wrong with everybody else. And I think that aspect of entertaining, we shouldn't just pass over too quickly. The sort of enjoyment we can get, particularly when we get together with others, right, and talk down somebody else. It can make us feel good. It can be enjoyable. We can have a good time. It can be entertaining. And we're creating a lot of suffering. She said, the habit of fault-finding is part of a larger pattern of insecurity in which we always feel the need to compare ourselves to other people. Why else would we do it, right? Why else would we feel the need to do that if there wasn't something within ourselves that needed to be built up, to feel better? And so one way of feeling better is to feel better because somebody else is less. It's as though we need to convince ourselves that we are okay, which we can only do indirectly in comparison to people who are less okay. And the thing about this practice is we never get to be okay. We never get to the point where we're finally okay, that we have so completely and utterly surpassed everyone else through our judging mind, that we are finally okay. That day never arrives. It's an endless, I would even say merciless, track, because there's always somebody new. There's always another situation. There's always another insecurity. And so I think when we really look at it and examine it more, that can give us a lot of some motivation and some faith in losing faith in that mind, because it comes with a lot of conviction. So how do we practice this? Well, I mean, in a way, the simplest, most direct practice is the one that you already know. Don't suppress it. Don't deny or ignore that that thought is arising. It's not a crime. It's not you. It's just a thought. It's just energy that's appearing in a certain way that has this deep habit and has consequence, but it's just a thought. So to not deny it or suppress it, but at the same time, and this is most critical, to not indulge it. You know, when Shantideva and many other teachers talk about sort of establishing a sentry who is guarding your senses, right? To be very careful about who comes in and out. It's kind of like that. It's like establishing a watchfulness, a wakefulness, an alertness about that tendency. I remember years ago when I became acutely aware, well, acutely enough that I became aware of this ongoing tendency within myself, and I was always turning outward. It was never satisfied. It was misery-making for me, and I'm pretty sure it was misery-making for others because I made that misery. And I realized I have to really take responsibility for this. And so I did exactly that. When it would arise, I would try and be as diligent as I could, as vigilant as I could, and not kill it, not extinguish it, but practice it, not indulge it, not engage in that pleasurable, entertaining, habitual pattern. In other words, we have to begin caring more about others, the one we're judging, and actually ourselves. Because in that judging, it seems like we're taking care of ourselves because we're elevating ourselves, but it actually isn't. It's just pain-making. And so to see the effect that it has on us can help see the effect it has on others. We can also just take in more of that person. Because if we are sort of reducing person to an action or an attribute and making that absolute, we can consciously make our mind larger and see them for more than that. Because they are no one is reducible to one thing. In other words, consciously give attention to someone else's good attributes, their good qualities. We can see what we have in common. Years ago, there was a person, in monasteries, it said that every time there's one person who's been invited to be here and designated to make you unhappy, to annoy you, to irritate you, right? And if they leave, somebody else is going to replace them. There was such a person at a particular time, and who was that person for me. And one of the ways I worked with it, with myself, was I would keep remembering that person was here. They're practicing. So whatever annoying qualities I was laying on them, and people can have annoying qualities, but what I was laying on this person and making much larger than they were or needed to be, I realized, but they're actually practicing. They're doing the same thing I'm doing. They're obviously wanting to affect change. They're wanting to do something about themselves. And that was really helpful, to recognize that we are different at the same time that we have the same nature. We come from different backgrounds, from different economies, from different lives. We live in different bodies. We've grown up in different worlds with different conditions. We've developed, each of us has developed certain things in our lives and maybe other things not so much. And when we judge someone, we're generally always judging them based on the standards that I choose, right? They're the things I declare are important because it's self-referential, which means that I may not see, will likely not see, the things that they've developed, that they're really good at, that they're, that make them beautiful, because those things aren't important to me. I don't recognize them. Judy says we should trust our own experience. We don't have to compare it to that of another person. She said, loosen the tendency to be so fascinated with what is wrong with everybody else, which makes us unable to see what is right and good about them. Instead of covering up our own faults and highlighting the faults of others, we should do the exact opposite. In other words, rather than turning the attention to others, we should keep our attention on ourselves. We should see, well, what are my errors and faults? What are the things that I would benefit from if I strengthened? In other words, as we live together and care for each other, at the same time, in a sense, to mind our own business. And then to take advantage of those moments of giving, when we can be giving, when we can offer a kind speech, when we can offer a beneficial action, just to do something simple. It's an ordinary form of language that often doesn't require any words. But everybody understands it. And when we do that, it's received. A simple gesture of generosity, a sincere word of kindness, an action that perhaps in some small way will make it easier for somebody. Dogen says, to skillfully benefit another, that is to care about their distant and near future and to help them by using skillful means, to care about them in the present and in the future. So those are actions of compassion and loving kindness. We can practice sympathetic joy, right? When we see ourselves becoming prideful or envious or jealous, be conscious of that and try and transform that into happiness or, appreciation. I remember sitting in this zendo at various times and begrudging, feeling jealous, competitive, because somebody else was more compassionate. Somebody else was more articulate. Somebody else was better at this or that. And I just kept trying to stop myself and say, wait a minute, really? Like, is that really what is important? Is that why I came here? Dogen said, deluded people think that if they help others, their own benefit will be lost. But this is not so. Beneficial action is an act of unity. Judy says, strangely, when we're not afraid to uncover our own flaws and we're not constantly comparing ourselves to others, it's actually a great relief. Hallelujah. I mean, think about all of that time and energy and emotion and investment that is invested, right? And that is invested in something that basically has a lot of heaviness to it, a lot of pain. And so the more we can relieve ourselves of that, the more joyful we will naturally experience ourselves. And the world changes. We see people differently. We experience people differently. And like so much of what we do, it's a practice, right? In a way, it's very accessible and I would say easy to practice because it's a thought. It's a judgment, right? It's a mental construction in that moment. We see that. It arose. It wasn't there a moment ago. We're learning how to practice letting go of thoughts. That's what we do. So in that way, it's not complicated. What makes it difficult is that it's so pervasive. And it's got so much strength to it. That's what makes it difficult, so much conviction. But in a way, you could say, okay, well, that just is going to give us so many more opportunities to practice it, right? Because it's not just now and then. So, you know, if you miss the chance, it's gone, right? Just don't go anywhere and you'll get another chance. And so in that way, it's very accessible. Dogen quotes this passage in that fascicle and says, the ocean does not exclude water. That's why it's so large. The mountain does not exclude soil. That's why it's so high. Not excluding, not forsaking, not rejecting. Even if the water is polluted, right? Even if the soil is not fertile, it doesn't exclude. To see the perfection, to realize self and other as one, that there's one self nature, one mind, and that self nature manifests in 100,000 million ways. And within each of us, it manifests along the way, within our delusion, within our samsaric attachments and views and habit patterns and so on, as we are practicing and transforming those. And so we can remember that just as I am not defined by my actions, and I don't want anybody to define me by my action, by one action, others are not defined by their actions too. So I should not do that to you, because I know how that feels when that is done to me. I can change, so can you. I can be stubborn, so can you. I can act poorly, particularly when I'm stressed or tired or scared. Maybe you can too. I want to be free and unhindered. Maybe you do too. So within our differences, perhaps the more important things, the most important things are not so different. And so to practice this judging mind, to see it arise and to not indulge. And when we do, when we get swept away, to try and keep your eyes open. You know, offered a poem recently, and I said something about, follow the example of the cat who always has one eye open, right? There's always an alertness. And so even as we're being swept downstream in our judging to try and keep one eye above the water, it's like, oh, I am caught in this. I am in my mind doing this to you. I see that. That's different. That's quite different than not seeing that. That's changing. That's a changing awareness. And to not, we should never underestimate the power of our intention, of volition. I was reading a teaching recently that said, in our intentions, that's how we can intervene, right? Because we can establish an intention. I can wake up and at my altar make a vow, establish an intention today that I'm going to really practice the judging mind. I can do that. And I can do that no matter how I feel. I can feel lousy. I can feel judging of everybody. I can wake up feeling as sour as milk. And I can still voice that intention to myself. That's the power of intention. And in that way, I am intervening. I am interrupting. I am stepping into that very powerful mind and emotional state. And I am reclaiming some of that power. I see you, I feel you, I see where this is going, but I am committed to freeing myself of this. That the ocean does not exclude water, Dogen says, is identity action. Water does not exclude the ocean either, it goes both ways. This being so, water comes together to form the ocean, and soil piles up to form mountains. And right intentions lead us deeper and deeper into the path, and cultivating and practicing in accord with these teachings frees us. If we want to be of benefit, this is a good path. If we want to give, if we care about how we are affecting others, this is a very important and powerful way that we can do that. Because it's so such a human, you know, pervasive and deep habit that we all have. Which means it's workable, right? So we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't ignore it or take it lightly, but we also shouldn't get overwrought. We shouldn't turn it into something more than it is. Just practice it. Keep it simple, keep it light. But practice it.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.